南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Hello, friends. I hope this recording finds you in good health and secure. If you find these podcasts, whether they're videos or the oral podcast, you can download at the Buddhahood podcast. Please consider supporting this effort, this channel for our Sangha. Certainly by subscribing, which helps us algorithmically, as does liking the video or even commenting. All of those things figure into YouTube's magical formulas. But even more so, some of you, who I have to thank once again, have the financial opportunity to even if it's small, if it's consistent every month through Patreon, or even at the paypal.me/SifuSylvain, if you go to PayPal, they have a one-time or recurring donation engine. That's massively helpful to keep things afloat here. And then there are those of you who've sent candles, incense, those kinds of things. All of that helps keep our channel at its most productive. As long as I have my health, yeah? So, let's get back into this introduction, lengthy as it is, of the Lankavatara, because it's not simply an introduction to the Lankavatara. It's actually an introduction to many Mahayana concepts in preparation for the translation of the Lankavatara, which I thought was a useful reminder of the early context of Mahayana Buddhism. Yes, we practice the ultimate Mahayana teaching, the teaching of the Lotus Sutra, Shakyamuni's elucidation of how we ourselves are not only responsible and capable, but the mechanism of enlightenment is a personal journey. And it can only be experienced through your own mind. This makes Buddhism incredibly unique, because my path to awakening is not your path to awakening. There are many steps and many similar experiences, and this is the benefit of the Sangha, as I share with you my own 40 plus years of practice and study, 50 plus years really. We can share from our own perspective, oh, I know what he's talking about. Oh man, I felt I would say it differently, but I know what he's talking about. Well, it's important that you pay attention to your insights, which you could say we do naturally, but I want you to feel your own reward. I want you to understand that as you gain insights, whether it's through watching these videos or podcasts, listening to podcasts, or your own independent research, which I always encourage, you will have flashes of brilliance. You will have flashes of, I get this. And you may not even be able to put words to it, but note those flashes, because that is something Shakyamuni talked about all the time. And in a way, this author is going to put words around his way of communicating about that. But, you know, when we read other people's words, it sometimes can be or seem convoluted or even alchemical. Like somebody is, it could seem, the words may seem somewhat mystical. But don't let that distract you. He's trying to get at something here. And let's, for ourselves, see if we can't peer into that through our own lenses, right? So I prefaced what I'm about to read with my own version of the insights that we get and the, what's important to remember, the self-enlightenment, self-practice. Nichiren spent his whole life trying to nail this down for our time period, yeah? So we just got done talking about the paravritti, this purification of mind, right? And the tendency, because we're social creatures, right, is to see this as something of like a restaurant. This food is available for everyone. And, you know, that will get you so far in Buddhism. But the point in Buddhism always is that you're the preparer of the food, and your particular dish will be your particular dish. You can share it, but in sharing it, those other people's experience of that dish will be theirs. It won't be yours. That's a samsaric problem of attachment and identification. So here we go. This next part is called Self-Discipline and the Buddha's Power. This rhetoric of the Buddha's power, the transcendental powers, that we hear this all the time, and I've already tried to disabuse you of that language, understanding that this is a power of perception. This is the mind's work and the mind's capacity for observation of the fundamental truths of situation rather than the colors that we samsaric beings impose on things, right? So here we go. As long as paravritti is an experience and not mere understanding, it is evident that self-discipline plays an important role in the Buddhist life. So in one sentence, he encapsulated exactly what I'm introducing this chapter with, yeah? But if you don't take it apart, you might miss a lot of that sentence is dense with information, you might say. You know, he says the experience and not mere understanding. Just because you can speak eloquently about it or be able to encapsulate it in language doesn't mean that you're fully experiencing it. See, that's an interesting facet of our human mind, isn't it? We're so excellent at data collection and creating language around our understanding of the data that it can seem like we've had the experience. But we'd be fooling ourselves to do that. Some of you know this because I've responded to some questions with, until you have your proper altar and your proper mandala and you sit down and single-mindedly instantiate Buddha, chant for a while, none of this, everything's going to just sound like a bunch of words. It's not going to have real meaning until you experience it. Isn't that true of everything? Right? I know some people who dissect every move and decision on a football field, but they've never stepped onto the turf. They've never had that smell of the turf, the feeling of the shoes and the cleats, the pads, the breathing, the helmet, the sounds, the smell, the feeling, the rush. Those things are experienced. Then you can know football. You see what I'm saying? This is insisted upon in the Lanka, as is illustrated in the use of such phrases as, quote, do not rely on others, strive yourselves, and so on. Right? So this is the preparatory teaching in Mahayana that leads us to the Lotus Sutra. This is something you must do in your own mind. You can't just belong to a group and have it. You can't just read all the books and know it, right? He's still talking to Shravakaness and Pratyekabuddhaness and ego arhatness. The intellectual experience isn't enough. You must mentally be in Buddha to fully appreciate emancipation, liberation, and the value of this life, this physical form, in propagating that experience. So we're not quite there yet, but the Lankavatara takes this as a critical juncture in understanding realization, awakening, enlightenment, yeah? So I see my, what is going on with you? Am I losing frames again? Okay, sorry about that. So let's go on. Strive yourselves. But at the same time, we must not forget the fact that the Lanka also emphasizes the necessity of the Buddha's power being added to the Bodhisattvas in their upward course of spiritual development and in the accomplishment of their great task of world emancipation. So we've already discussed this many times. In our human form, we have the opportunity to act upon our experience of awakening as communicators, as assemblers, as so many adjectives, as minds integrating with other minds to draw people's curiosity, people's volition toward this goal of awakening, enlightenment. That's what we're here for. That's what we do. But the caution here is, don't get lost in the functions of Bodhisattva alone without dipping into that well of enlightenment, Buddha. That is what supports, informs, corrects, inspires, radiates to others. Your bodhisattva-ness is not the result of simply study. Study helps with your conviction and your ability to communicate, but unless you experience your own Buddha Gohanzon, your gate to all-knowing Buddha, then all of that study and eloquence and language, it has little influence. It may get people started, but ultimately it's incomplete. with far fewer words, you can inspire much greater commitment with your experience of enlightenment. So that's what's being said here. It's easy to get lost in the minutiae and do all the perfunctory, sounds like there's a bird in here, distractions, yes? If they were not so, if they were not thus, so constantly sustained by the power of the Buddha, they would speedily fall into the group of philosophers and shravakas, and they would never be able to attain supreme enlightenment and preach the doctrine of universal emancipation. What I just said. Indeed, when the Buddha so wishes, even such inanimate objects as mountains, woods, palaces, etc., will resound with the voice of the Buddha, how much more the bodhisattvas who are his spiritual inheritors. So there we are again with anthropomorphizing Buddha, right? His spiritual inheritors. It's not a his, it's Buddha-ness inherent in our samsaric minds, lives. The doctrine of Adisthana gains all the more significance when we consider the development of Mahayana Buddhism into the doctrine of emancipation by conviction alone. Well, conviction alone, if you're disassembling language here, conviction has to be directed, right? And so what directs your conviction, your confidence, your knowingness? Only the experience of Buddha can function in that equation, right? The power of a bodhisattva's original vows may also be judged as being derived from the Buddha. Well, of course. If you take vows as a bodhisattva because you think it's cool to be a bodhisattva, and because you like to study or you like to prance around like you know it all, right? There's all kinds of motivations to call yourself a bodhisattva. But truly a bodhisattva is somebody who communicates without the, I was going to say, the accoutrement, the books, the learning, all of that is excellent. But that's not what makes you a bodhisattva. That's just a monk. That's a student. A dedicated student is a monk. That's what we are. When we achieve bodhi, that's because our communication is fed by, supported by, imbued with our experience of Buddha mind. That's bodhi. The power of a bodhisattva's original, if the possibility of enlightenment is due to the adhisthana or prabhava of the Buddha, all the wonders that are to take place by the strength of the enlightenment must be inferred ultimately to issue from the fountainhead of Buddhahood itself. Okay, you finally got to it. At any rate, the Mahayana idea of the Buddha being able to impart his power to others marks one of those epoch-making deviations which set off the Mahayana from so-called primitive or original Buddhism. Again, this is an evolution of the term bodhisattva from a teacher to somebody who's actually channeling Buddhahood into other people's, other minds' experiences. Don't get me wrong, it's not that a bodhisattva looks you in the eye and suddenly you experience Buddhahood. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that a true bodhisattva who is inspired by, motivated by his or her experience of Buddha is a far more deeply reaching, albeit by words and acts, imbuing other minds with a seeking of, what have you got there? What is that thing you're talking about? Instead of being glued to, those are nice words, I like the way you said that. But hearing those words, feeling that communication, and arising a curiosity, a wanting to find the source of what motivates those words. That's a very different thing. And Mahayana is where that is firmly seized upon and dissected. Whereas in Hinayana, it was all about the self, the ego, doing these things. The Bodhi transcends the ego, the self, to something that's far more encompassing, universal, in fact. Not minimizing our human form, existence, apparatus, but in a way exalting it as the portal, the vehicle for a much larger understanding and experience of life. Follow? At any rate, did I just read that? The Mahayana idea of the Buddha being able to impart his power to others marks one of those epoch-making deviations which set off the Mahayana from so-called primitive original Buddhism. When the Buddha comes to be considered capable of adhisthana, the next step his devotees are logically led to take would be the idea of vicarious suffering or atonement. Ooh, I don't like those words. Atonement especially. That's all religion. Giving power to another is a positive idea, while suffering for another may be said to be a negative one. Okay. I'm thinking of a lot of religions here, where somehow atonement for, apologizing for life, or apologizing for you having a life, right? Crucifixion, all that stuff. That's a negative aspect of living life. That's not a positive one. Though this latter is strangely absent in the Lanka, right? There is no atonement in Buddhism. The Gandavyuha, as well as the Prajnaparamita, are quite eloquent in elucidating the doctrine of vicarious suffering. Not sure what he's trying to say there, but vicarious suffering would imply that suffering isn't needed. It's something that's imposed, and we impose it on ourselves. And yes, that is fundamental Buddhism. Vicarious suffering, strange words to use, but not inaccurate. According to this doctrine, whatever suffering one is enduring may be transferred on to another if the latter sincerely desires, out of his unselfish and all-embracing love for others, to take these sufferings upon himself so that the real sufferers may not only be relieved of them but escape their evil consequences, thus enabling him to advance more easily and successfully toward the attainment of blissful life. That's total crap. That idea that you can take upon yourself through your loving compassion somebody else's sufferings so that you can relieve them. Suffering is self-created. You can't take it from you can't give Buddha-ness to someone, nor can you take away their karmic freight train. It is a self-practice, a self-realizing enlightenment. So that idea that he just laid out, total religion, total bullshit, okay? This goes quite against the idea of individual responsibility, does it not? But really, religious minds require this vicarious suffering for their spiritual life. In other words, not in Buddhism. This is the province of religions, this derision, this magical thinking that somehow you can take on somebody else's burdens and clear the path for them. No, you're just, if you want to take on somebody's burdens, their loans or their financial responsibility or their children or any of that, that's something you are doing of your own for your life. You are not affecting their lives in any form whatsoever. In fact, you may be compounding their negative karma, because now they don't have to be responsible. And this is a feature of religion. Escaping responsibility is the leitmotif of every religion. And it is absolutely opposite to Buddhism. Buddhism never does that. You and I are ultimately responsible for our life experience. Period. End of sentence. It comes from that idea that life is happening to us. What a derision. What an insult to life. Life is our immediate experience, perception. It's our mirror in the form, in this apparatus. It's all about you. It's not happening to you, it's happening for you. For you to experience, to see, to immerse yourself in. There's nothing wrong or bad about life. To suffer or atone vicariously is still negative and fails to entirely satisfy our spiritual needs. Of course, it's derision. The latter demand that more good must be done in order to suppress the evils which are found claiming this world for their own glorification. So the Mahayanas accumulate stocks of merit not only for the material of their own enlightenment, but for the general cultivation of merit, which can be shared equally by their fellow beings, animate and inanimate. Okay, he's getting a little slippery here. He's like, I thought he was just defining the boundaries of Mahayana Buddhism as opposed to all other acts that are religious in nature. And he did touch on that. But I get the sense that he's not entirely liberated from it himself. And this is a good example of being Sravaka-like, being intellectual and knowing a lot of good formulas of words without actually inculcating them into his own life experience. Maybe I'm wrong. Let's go on. This is the true meaning of the pranamana, that is, turning one's merit over to others for their spiritual interest. At very least, I would reword that in context of our practice, that our Buddha-ness, as I was expressing Bodhi, is that we are inspiration for others to do the same. We don't imbue them with Buddha. We don't imbue them with Bodhi. We give them a target to aim for themselves, to accrue, like you and I are doing right now, our own insights, our own knowledge, albeit with great support for one another. But that's not the same as, here, let me give you merit so that you can practice. The merit comes from your practice. I can't shoehorn it into your mind. I can only support your effort. That's Mahayana. That's Lotus Sutra. Oh, sorry. Man, all kinds of aches and pains. Getting old, people. All right, that makes sense, right? So it's a little muddy here. As I said elsewhere, this notion of prajnamana is not at all traceable in the Lanka, which is strange. Well, yeah, because this is a sutra from Shakyamuni, supposedly, and he ain't going to talk religion like you are. The Lanka cannot be imagined to have been compiled prior to the Prajnaparamita, nor to the Gandhavyuha or Avatamsaka. If so, why this absence? How can this be explained? Buddha, the enlightened, and Shravastava, the ignorant. Shravastava. To conclude this section, Buddhism is the story of a relationship between the two groups of being. The one is called Buddha, who is the enlightened, the Tathagata, and he includes the Arahat. No. And the other is generally designated as Sarvasattva, literally all beings, who are ignorant, greedy for worldly things, and therefore in perpetual torment. Okay, I don't have issue with any of those statements, except including Arahat in with Tathagata. No, this is huge, huge. How this guy could be talking about the separation from Mahayana and primitive Buddhism, using his words, and not understanding the nature of primitive early teachings of Buddhism, that very term, arhat, is the fulcrum. Because an arhat is a self-egotistical experience of all these accomplishments, still an arhat. Not fully enlightened. That's the definition of an arhat, not fully enlightened. So for him to include arhat as just another name for Tathagata or Buddha, nowhere else we've never seen that in any sutra. So Mr. Suzuki, what are you smoking? In spite of their hankering for worldly enjoyments, they are conscious of their... He's talking about all of us, right? But why they? Why not we? Are all conscious of their condition and not at all satisfied with it. When they reflect, they find themselves quite forlorn inwardly. They long for real happiness, for ultimate reality and blissful enlightenment. That's your ignorant people, right? This is the world of suffering, you know. Why me? How can I make this better? A lot of people don't even go that far. It's just why me all the time, yeah? And gimme, gimme, gimme. They look upwards, where the Buddha sits, wrapped in his meditation, serenely regarding them with his transcendental wisdom. As he looks down, the up and down, right, at his fellow beings, there's all kinds of problems in the terminology here, you hear it, inexplicably tormented with their greed and ignorance and egotism, he is disturbed, for he feels an inextinguishable feeling of love stirring within himself. The feeling now perfectly purified of all the defilements of selfishness, which embrace the whole world in pity, though not attached to it. The Buddha leaves his transcendental abode. He is seen among sentient beings, each one of whom recognizes him according to his own light. Oh man, I'm really struggling with this rhetoric because we get the sense from this story that this author is telling us, that Buddha is not unlike Jesus Christ. He sees from his mighty perch all the suffering, and all he wants to do is come down to earth and walk among us and make us all feel better. Man, that's a horrible, horrible analogy. Because as you and I know, as practitioners of the Lotus Sutra, Shakyamuni's ultimate teaching, and through the guidance of our modern teacher, Nichiren, Buddha is inherent. It's in us. It's our mind. It's not some guy who comes down and pats us on the back. It's your own mind reevaluating your earthly experience and casting away all the crap that we're hanging on to so that we can see clearly how amazing this life is. This is something we are exercising in our minds. So, is our mind above or below? Is it suffering? Is it not? That's a matter of moment to moment. How are you using your mind? I can't give you the use of my mind and go, here, plug that into your ear. You get it? No, you have to discover it for yourself. But you are the source, the propagator, the experiencer, the witness, the consciousness. You. It doesn't come from elsewhere. So this storytelling about looking down on and being, your beautiful Buddha mind is not happy about your egotistical attachments and sufferings. And you lament those sufferings all the time. But who are you talking to? Some savior? You're talking to your own mind. But you mostly fail to recognize it until you start practicing Buddhism. So that's the dividing line. The ignorant just talk to themselves and complain. And sometimes have successes and they feel good. But Buddhism introduces the idea that there's no chance organization here about whether or not you feel good or bad. It's a choice that you need to make. And all of the transcendental power is in your mind. That's Buddha. It's nowhere else. So I really dislike that last sentence or paragraph. Let's go on. Maybe he'll come back around. So far he seems to be walking a line as he's talking here through this introduction, right? On the one hand, he seems to know, and then he slips into this regurgitation of strangeness. And I hope that that's not what his translation of the Lagavatara will treat us to. Remains to be seen. Continuing. Transcendental wisdom, prajna, and a heart of all-embracing love, mahakaruna, constitute the very reason of Buddhahood. While the desire or thirst for life, trishna, and ignorance as to the meaning of life, avidya, and deeds, karma, following from the blind assertion of life impulse, these are the factors that enter into the nature of sarvastva, all ignorant and infatuated ones. The one who is above, looking downward, there's that, I don't like that, extends his arms to help. The other, unable to extricate himself from entanglements, looks up in despair, life is happening to me, and finding the helping arm, stretches his own to take hold of them. And from this scene, the following narrative, psychological, logical, and ontological, unfold themselves to the Buddhist soul. Suzuki, what is wrong with your mind? How can you on the one hand understand and on the other hand become such a religious fool? Ugh, I'm not impressed. You know, of course, no such thing as a soul in Buddhism. There's entire sutras and books and analyses and Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu and endless scholars who will talk to you about anatman, this very idea of a box, a bag of Betty. It's just fantasy. We live moment to moment. That's where we are all the time, in the moment. We don't carry a hefty bag of what we used to be. Of what use would that be anyway? Except some romantic version of eternal bobness? Blech! That's not Buddhism. It's not Hinayana Buddhism. It's not Mahayana Buddhism. It's not Buddhism. Where he comes up with this stuff is really annoying. Now he's going to attempt to talk to us about psychology, which, you know, as a topic, is very samsaric. Let's see what he does with this. What may be termed Buddhist psychology in the Lanka, specifically, consists in the analysis of mind, okay? That is, in the classification of the Vijnanas. Now he's talking about the 12-linked causal chain, the Vidana, right? Or Nidana. To understand thus the psychology of Buddhism properly, the knowledge of these terms is necessary. The citta, the manas, the vijnana, the mano-vijnana, and the alaya-vijnana. Once again, he only gets to the eighth consciousness. No knowledge of the ninth. Not in this introduction, nor in this translation of the Lankavatara. So we see where he's lacking constantly. He doesn't understand the Buddha mind, Buddha consciousness. He just doesn't. He doesn't even have a name for it, right? It's still somewhat mystical in Mr. Suzuki's mind. How that will affect his translation of the Lankavatara remains to be seen, yeah? But make a note. To begin with Vijnana, Vijnana is composed of the prefix vi, meaning to divide, and the root jna, which means to perceive, to know. Thus, Vijnana is the faculty of distinguishing or discerning or judging, right? Identification. When an object is presented before the eye, it is perceived and judged as a red apple or a piece of white linen. The faculty of doing this is called the eye vijnana, a eye consciousness. And you could dissect it more, and I've got videos on the Nidana. I've got papers on the Nidana you could download for free off of threefoldlotus.com on the core study materials page, yeah? So the eye consciousness, if you follow it through the cycle of birth and death, this human life, is a desire to know the world, the universe, through its appearance. And to know the universe through appearance, we have to have a device that's able to discern the elements of that universe. Long story short, we make an eye that has a faculty or facility to take impressions from the thingifying of the universe and process that information into a brain that can assemble what the object of that consciousness is. What the eye sees. And that whole process of creating the eye that sees light and then takes that data and processes it into a thing very interesting to think of it that way, from energy, karma, manifest, a perceiver, of a tool of perception, that then gets manipulated in the brain to make associations and identifications to then store as knowledge. It's really just another, it's a thing. And then our mind decides how to feel about that thing. Do I like that thing? Do I hate that thing? Do I want to avoid that thing? Do I want to have that thing? Do I want to eat that thing? You can see this process happening in babies. Everything goes in their mouth. Is this food? Can I eat this? No, this is hard. Oh, this is... Ugh. Making decisions about, I see this. I analyze this. This is not for me. Oh, I kind of like this one. I'll suck on it for a while. We're developing our relationships with things. And we don't only use our eyes, but this is why in Buddhism, these faculties of seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, right? They are the process of attachment and desire. They are very problematic, not on their own. They're super useful on their own. But if our identity becomes that action, we have left our true identity, which is fascination, but not attached. Observing the machine rather than being the machine. Do you see? The Vijnana, the Nidana, all of the books I've written and the chapters I've written on this, they all deal with this duality, yeah? So if the Buddha comes down to address that, it's all happening in the mind, not in some ethereal place, high or low. All right. When an object is presented before the eye, it's perceived, blah, blah, blah. In the same way, there are ear vijnana for sounds, nose vijnana for odor, tongue vijnana for taste, body vijnana for touch, and thought vijnana, mano vijnana, for ideas. Interesting. That's a separate consciousness, right? The various altogether six forms of vijnana for distinguishing the various aspects of the world, external or internal. Those are the six lower realms. It's all connected. And I was looking at videos the other day, the one where I talked most recently about the nine consciousnesses. I think it's titled Nidana. Skandhas, nine consciousnesses, and maybe Myoho Renge Kyo. So if you'll just go to the home page of this channel and type in the little search in the middle there, not the top one, the middle one, and type in the word consciousnesses or nine consciousnesses, you should come up with, there'll be a handful of videos about the nine consciousnesses. But the one that starts with Nidana, Skandhas, nine consciousnesses, I listed these different aspects of peering into this situation. I think you'll find that video quite full of information, especially in the context of this is what we dissect when we chant. The reason we have a mandala and the reason we chant is to involve all those other consciousnesses to be focused on the same place instead of all the divergences and distractions of the bird outside and my little dog snorting and all these other things. When we chant to mandala, we focus all of those consciousnesses on Buddhahood. Gohanzen of Buddhahood. Yes? And I think on that note, I'm going to stop. And we'll continue with this discussion in the next video. It's interesting here. I have my issues with Mr. Suzuki, obviously. But I also want to give him some room for error because we are talking about an earlier Mahayana teaching, right? So obviously it's not going to have the clarity of the Lotus Sutra. But there are some basic tenets here that by the time we get to the Lankavatara, this guy should know. So I'm a little perturbed that his daily influences in his life are not entirely clear on the scholarship of Buddhism, that he's allowing some kind of sectarian experience that has pulled historically, possibly from Japanese, Shinto and other influences, even Christian. You know, we live in a world of very mixed views on how the world exists and how it works. And even a Buddhist is influenced by his environs, his culture, his family, right? Or her family, but in this case, it's a guy. That's why I keep saying it. It's hard when you're trying to practice clearly and seek out authoritative analysis to be handed these publishings from supposed authorities that miss the mark so badly. They hit the mark. Suzuki has said some very good things, very accurate things. And yet, there's always this underlying mishmash. And it's hard to resolve the two. How can you know this and then drag that along with you? How can you resolve that? Hopefully, because of our Sangha and our dedication, my dedication certainly, and that I'm sharing with you, for true and accurate information, I can call it out. Because I believe that unless you can discern the correct practice from politic, personal or otherwise, you're going to be muddled and it's going to impede what should be a very easy thing. Namo myoho renge kyo. Attain your Buddha-ness. Do it now. And you guys are working on that. You're doing that every day. So I am grateful. And I'm speaking of my little dog snorting. I was almost on cue, wasn't it? So appreciate your being here and listening. Please don't forget to like and subscribe. I so appreciate your practice. Stay strong. Be kind to yourself. And we'll continue with Mr. Suzuki's introduction here. And then we'll get into the Lankavatara, which I think is a very interesting sutra. Albeit a translation, yes? Take care of your life. Namo myoho renge kyo. Be kind to yourself. Bye for now.